Hey everybody, good evening. My name is Jeff Circle. I'm here with John Stamp, as always, for the Writer Stuff podcast. And tonight we've got an awesome guest. Everybody knows Mark Greeny. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to see you guys.
Yeah, you too. John, how you doing?
Man, I am outstanding. I couldn't be better if I tried.
Well, we've taken a couple weeks off here lately, and it's really great to be back. And it's even better to be back with the author of Midnight Black. If you haven't picked up a copy of Midnight Black, now is the time. This podcast is not sponsored by Midnight Black. Not a sponsor yet, but we're glad to have you here, Mark. Wow. So there is so much going on right now. And everybody always used to talk about, and they probably still do, no disrespect to Brad Thor on being Nostradamus, but holy crap. Russia, all this stuff going down. And the cool thing about what you've done, which I couldn't do as a former counterintelligence guy in the army, I couldn't go to Russia. That would not be cool. Pretty much at any time, John would get scooped up. Lubyanka. Well, life would be very difficult for John Stimp right now if he went to Russia. But you, Mark, you went to Russia. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go now. I don't care who you are. If you're, a Western passport holder over there now, you could get scooped up and traded back, you know, down the road for somebody else. But you might be sitting there. I was on an interview and I said that, and somebody said, "Oh, you'd probably sell a lot of books." I'm like, I'm doing okay, honestly. I don't really need to kick it up to the next level by going to the prisons over there. But yeah, I was writing a book with Tom Clancy. It was actually Command Authority, the last book before Clancy died. And I spent, about 10 days in Moscow and about 5 days in St. Petersburg. And all those, there's locations in the book in Midnight Black that are right out of the Moscow subway and Gorky Park, places that I went. But even back then, I had a guy following me around, and it was nothing to, I'm not saying that to make me sound sexy. I think it was just like they wanted to see if I was going to talk to somebody that they would have been interested that was talking to me, you know, that sort of a thing. And there was nothing subtle about it. It was just some dude following me around. I only noticed, and I wasn't like looking for that sort of stuff. And I'm not really well trained on finding somebody that doesn't want to be found, but that guy was just like, hey, that guy was in Goom, or what used to be Goom department store. Now it's like a mall. It's like, hey, I saw that guy standing outside of our restaurant while we were eating, and then I saw that guy over here on Red Square, and I saw that guy over by the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and he walked over and took a picture of my girlfriend and then walked off. And it's like he wasn't trying to be covert.
He wasn't even trying.
Yeah. But you know, I got a lot out of it, you know, that trip. And I used it on the Clancy book. I wrote a book with Clancy, as I said, called Command Authority. And it came out in December of 2013. And it was about Russia invading, taking over Crimea and the Eastern Oblast. And then in February or March of 2014, that all happened. So, and here we are again, 10 years later. It's funny, I had a proxy for Vladimir Putin back then, a guy named Valery Volodin in the Clancy books, and he'd already been president on and off for 13 years, and here we are 10 years later, 12 years later, and he's still president. Which tells you all you need to know about what's going on over there.
It's a democratically elected president every time.
Yeah. So anyone wants to know what's happening in the world next month, just watch where Mark Greeny's doing his research for his 27th published novel, The 15th Court Gentry. Gray Man book you're working on right now. But first, let's just stay on Russia real quick. Russian sabotage operations in the U.S. Mark, is there anything we need to know about?
Well, so in the U.S., it's mostly some cyber stuff. They were trying to affect water supplies. And there have been some Havana Syndrome incidents in Washington, D.C. And I've done a lot of research on that just out of curiosity. That doesn't factor into the book. And, it's sort of microwave pulse weapon. And it looks very much like it's GRU, because there is a doctor, I don't know if you know this, but Unit 29155, which is one of their assassination and active measures groups outside the U.S., outside of Russia. A doctor who works for them actually published a paper on how, in 2007, I think, on advances in pulse microwave technology to affect brains, and they've got a pictures of a oh, this open source stuff of pictures of a GRU 29155 guy was identified in Malta outside of where somebody got zapped. So I think that's probably what's going on. We're having a hard time admitting it out loud, but you know, it's that whole thing that we the West calls it destabilizing actions or malicious actions. And the Russians, you know, it's just war to them. Ukraine is just one front in the war with the West, in my opinion, and everything they can do to sow fear, doubt, and division, they're going to do. So they are doing tons of sabotage operations in Europe. And there have definitely been some here as well.
Good times. Good times.
Yeah. Kind of telegraphed their shot with that one, publishing a paper right before you turn loose a new weapon.
Yeah, and there was a whole nother level to it because the guy, it was some organization that was like auditing the Russian military or something. And so he had to sort of prove what he was doing during a certain time period. So he turned it into there and somehow the West got a hold of it and somehow it got published. So it was this thing where he wasn't saying that, you know, that it wasn't trying to get out. He literally had to report his activities for a certain time period. He was, I was publishing this paper, this secret paper. And he, you know, he put it on some sort of open channel thing.
He had to do his five bullet points for the Russian opening up.
Yeah.
Use five bullet points, man.
That's what happens when you turn that in, I guess.
That's right.
Well, Mark, Midnight Black, I think you said it I think I heard you say that it's Cold War with John Wick. I mean, you worked with Clancy, and funny aside, I almost shot this to you over the weekend. I was at an estate sale and I saw one of your paperbacks that you did with Clancy. I was like, holy cow, I'm talking to Mark on Tuesday. But so I remember those Cold War books, and then we got away from all that, obviously for good reason, because there's a lot of Middle East stuff and other things going on. And now we're back, but we've added this really cool layer of heroes like Court Gentry, who we didn't have 20 years ago, 15 years ago. Yeah. And so is that a good description? Cold War with John Wick?
Yeah. First off, let me say, the moment your book starts showing up in estate sales, you know you're old. and I would love to say you're the first person to ever tell me that, but I can't. But yeah, you know, when I started writing this book, I wasn't thinking in those terms. I ended, you know, it's a standalone novel. All my books are standalone novel. But I ended the 13th Gray Man book with the woman that Court loves, Zoya Zakharova, getting snatched up by the Chinese and traded to Russia. And so it's very end of the book says she was taken to Moscow. So I kind of knew where this book was going to start. And I, you know, theoretically for those couple of months when I wasn't working on it after finishing the last one before starting this one, I was like, oh, next year's book's going to be easy. And it's not, because that little log line doesn't get you 150,000 words. And I was like, how do you make this interesting? And so as I started doing the research on the police state inside of Russia, you know, I've always been very interested in, you know, the war with Ukraine and things that they're doing vis-a-vis the rest of the world or the West. But I was looking at the situation in Russia and like what liberties people have and don't have and all that. It just started to evoke the feeling of the Cold War. And really early on in the story, I'm always looking when I'm writing for like, what's the heart of this story? What's the thing that's going to make me want to get up and go work on it every day? And if it's just, you know, guys running around shooting at each other, it doesn't excite me that much anymore. I'm looking for something else to where I go, oh, yeah, there's the heart of the story. And then once I said, oh, this could be an homage to the Cold War. And also that sort of demonstrates where we are in the world, or where I think we are in the world. And so that made it fun to work on this story. It was a hard book to write. It took me longer to write this book than anything I've ever done. And but I always just had it in my head that this is Cold War. Obviously, the John Wick comes in there because it's Court Gentry, and action's an important part of the story. And I mean, the setup just lends itself to action. You know, he's hooking up with different rebel groups. He's trying to do a raid to get somebody out of a prison. His sort of sidekick or buddy Zach Hightower is trying to stop sabotage operations by the GRU in Europe. So there's a whole lot of things that lend themselves to action. So, you know, it, theoretically, this book would have written itself, but I felt like I was working pretty hard getting it done. So there's some secret sauce in there.
Yeah, I heard you say this took you longer to write than any of the other 26 published novels. And was it just challenging yourself? Was it, I know you talked about writer's block, which really isn't just, you know, hey, get your butt in the chair and write. Yeah. But what was it that was something we wanted to be more authentic? Was it research? Was it too much noise at the coffee shop? Why did this one take longer?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think it just boils down to, it used to be easier and you're, you know, I think I spend more time trying to think of different ways to do things than I did before. I mean, you know, my first couple of Clancy novels, my first half dozen Gray Man novels, if I had an idea, I'm like, oh, this is going to be about Chinese intelligence trying to, you know, do an attack on America. So it's like, well, obviously you're going to involve the MSS. Obviously it's going to be this guy who's some like rogue operator, you know, it's just like you've done all the tropey stuff and you've done, you know, even if it's not tropey, you know, you've done it before. So, when I was writing this book, I was like, okay, so he's going to hook up with a group of people that are going to help him get into Russia. And I was like, what's interesting about that? What would be different? What's something I haven't done 12 times? And then I got the idea of, you know, I kept thinking about, I don't know if you guys ever saw that great movie, and it was a good book too, called Firefox. Clint Eastwood was in the movie.
Thinking about that.
You remember that? Yeah. You guys probably aren't old enough, but you might have seen it. I saw it in the theater. But there's Clint Eastwood just goes in this rat line into the Soviet Union, and these people help him move from place to place and stay underground. And I thought, you know, well, that's sort of what Court's going to be doing. And then I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if it was the same people, not specifically from Firefox, but people from that era? And I was like, instead of making a young group of people, you know, this could be the people that survived the Soviet Union. And here they are again, 35 years later, being asked to do the same thing and kind of reconstitute the ways that they snuck people in and out of the country. And I thought, well, that's different. That's something I haven't done, something I haven't seen. And so I started building with that. So little things like that take time. You think you just sit in front of the computer and the words flow, but you know, just the whole concept and the whole direction of that plot thing, just, it, you know, if it came to me in January, I would have had the book done earlier, but it probably came to me in June or something. And so that makes it go slower.
Now with the way, you know, you take that, that character tool or that plot mechanism, and as you're writing or as you sketch, like you said, that you had this rattling around in your head for a couple months as you got ready to be able to hit go on the writing process. How far do you get? Like how many of those iterations are there? And are you writing as you go and you get to like, say using, I don't know, you know, using a drug dealer to sneak you into Russia and you're like, it's been done. How far down the line do you get where you're like, oh crap, well, let me try this. And then you finally settle on the angry old men. And how much backwards rewriting do you have to do, or are you just kind of working it as you go?
Yeah, so that's the tough thing. Like that's the thing that makes, you know, people's image of what writing a book is like and the reality of, or at least my reality of writing a book, are so different, because there's just layers. You know, when you first start writing something, you're putting a really sloppy first primer coat on, you know, and you're just sort of going, I'll just write little scenes that I kind of know are going to happen. And they're probably not even, it's not even how they're going to end up. It's like, well, I know Court's got to meet this guy's dad or this woman's granddad. So I'll just have that scene. And maybe I don't even, sometimes I won't really orient it with like setting and stuff like that, but it really helps me to write, to like have a good fix on this setting. So it's like, let's put him in this alleyway, or let's put him in this stairwell, or let's put him in this restaurant or something. And then you just start writing. And I love dialogue. So a lot of times just the bouncing back and forth dialogue helps a lot. And, you know, as to your question, it's like sometimes you work it out and you spend weeks working it out in your head. And I'll make little notes here and there, but I'm one of those people that makes notes and makes outlines and never looks at them again. You know, there's, and you just sort of start over all the time. I still think there is a benefit to it, you know? And sometimes I go back and look at my notes and I'm like, yeah, no, I shit canned all that like 5 minutes after I wrote it down. But something along those lines was interesting. My editor was in town. I had a book signing over the weekend, and my editor was in town, and we sat there by the fireplace and talked about the book that I'm writing now for next year. And I was telling him about these big gaping plot hole problems I have, because it's still in the early stages. You know, it's like, I know I want this to happen. I know I want this to happen. These two things have to intersect, but I can't think of a corny way or not a like weird coincidence way. And so I was talking to my editor about it. We're bouncing things back. And it felt like we'd get somewhere and then we'd take a step back. And then he stayed at my house. And the next morning he came in and he's like, you know, I got in bed and I had this great idea and I worked on it in my mind for like an hour and a half. And I woke up and I worked on it some more and it totally doesn't work. And I was like, and so it helped me to go, you see what I'm doing. You know, you see where I am at this part of the process, but we did work some stuff out. So, you know, it's just slow and it's messy, but the more you're writing down, I mean, I just have one word document. I don't have like chapters. I don't use Scrivener. I've tried and I think it's amazing. I just kind of wish my brain was better with that. I just keep it in one word document and move pieces around and, you know, almost never totally eliminate something. I'll move it out of that into like a dump file for stuff that I don't think I'm going to use. But just slowly over the weeks and over the months, and you know, I at this stage in my career, I tell myself every hour I sit in front of my laptop, the book is somewhat better. So sit there,
right?
Sit there and think and work on it. You know, and at the end of 6 months or 8 months or 9 months, you'll have something.
Do you whiteboard stuff out, Mark? Do you have a whiteboard or anything? It's just all Word?
Yeah, it's just all Word. I use this thing called Evernote, which is just like a note taking. It's just almost like notes on your phone, but I use it on my laptop too. And so I will, you know, write Gray Man 15. And so I can type that in and see every note that I've taken about Gray Man 15, and I'll go back through it. But that's as organized as I am. I'm friends with Brad Taylor. I don't know if you've had him on before. Great guy. I think he does a whiteboard thing, and a lot of people do. And it just does. You do? Yeah. I think it looks great when I watch people do it. And I go like, I wish my brain worked that way. But every year I try to come up with some really cohesive outline. And I just feel like if I get that outline down, it's just paint by numbers. And I'm sure it's not. But right. But it to me, it's just a lot more amorphous, and it's just like pictures and colors and that sort of stuff. And I just have to get as much down on the page and move it around and clean it up. And I don't really like my books at all until about the third edit. And that makes me miserable to be around in the summer. But you know, I say this all the time. If I die when one of my books is 98% done, it's going to be completely unpublishable. I may be wrong, but in my brain, it's completely unpublishable.
Yeah, I think I have that conversation with my wife every time I get to the second read through. I'm like, this is garbage. Like, I've got 100,000 words of garbage. And then like 3 months later, I'm like, I think this might be good.
Yeah. And then, you know, this is my 26th published novel. So everyone in my world is so tired of hearing me say the same crap every year. And they don't believe me. But I keep saying I'm right every year. I'm coming closer to that precipice where I don't make this happen. And you know, nobody believes me. Everybody's like, yeah, just ignore him for 3 months and he'll be fine.
He'll be fine.
And so far that's worked. Mark. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So far that's worked, but it's not going to last forever.
All right, Mark, you're doing the 15th Gray Man book right now, having to do with, and I don't think this is a spoiler, Northern Ireland. You've got a setting set up. So I got two things. One, you created Core Gentry, but when you sit down now and you put him through the paces, when you imagine him in your head, do you see Ryan Gosling?
Yeah, seems like I would. And it seems like if I said I wasn't, I didn't, it sounds like I'm lying, but I really don't. I never really flesh out the faces of any of my characters. I don't really think of them that way. I guess see through their eyes, maybe. And, you know, I know Zach is tall and has blonde hair and is in his 50s, and Court has been 37 since 2009, just like me, is what I, that's my joke.
it works.
Yeah. You know, so I know in general, you know, but I don't really think about it. And honestly, I like the Gray Man film for what it was. I thought they did a really good job. And the best thing about it was Ryan Gosling, in my opinion. I thought he had the character pretty nuanced. There was nothing that I would have changed about his portrayal of the character. So it's not a knock on him. I mean, he was the best guy for the job, in my opinion. And I just don't really like see faces. Do you see faces of characters or I mean, a lot of people identify actors or actresses or famous people they want to use. I kind of used to see Matt Hanley, who's kind of Court's boss and puppet master at times. I used to like Philip Seymour Hoffman before he died. And I would kind of see Philip Seymour Hoffman, but I wouldn't, like, when I'm writing about Hanley, I wouldn't, you know, picture the actor. So I don't know. Do you guys do that?
I can't see it. Yeah. No.
Yeah. Yeah. I try to stay away from the actor bit. Kind of, but not really.
Yeah.
But you mentioned Philip Seymour Hoffman. He was one of the best bad guys ever in Mission Impossible.
Mission Impossible 4.
Yeah, was that so good.
Was that three or three?
It was three. Yeah, because I almost didn't go see it because of Mission Impossible 2. I was like, I'm never doing this again.
I'm with you. That is such an underrated film. And just the, you know, the stakes and, you know, how they opened it with his wife about to be executed. You know, it's just perfect. It's a masterclass on, you know, just starting out with breathless action and just only cranking it up to 11 and 12 and 13. It's everybody should see that.
Yeah, it's one of the best movies.
Yeah.
Hey, on a personal note, I wanted to tip my hat to you and Allison, your wife, with all of the great work that you guys have been doing, especially in the Memphis area with dogs.
Oh, thanks a lot. Yeah, I appreciate that.
I know John's a dog lover. I think most people are, but you too, you guys have really gone above and beyond. You know, we talk about the books and we talk about, you know, all kinds of stuff, but like I said, on a personal note, I think that's really wonderful. And I love the posts. So you guys keep that up.
Yeah.
That shows a really good side of you guys.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
Genuine.
We both, had rescue dogs, and my wife actually used to have her own rescue, and it was like one of the bigger ones here in Memphis. So she still has a lot of contacts in the foster community. So we foster, you know, kind of my rule is when I turn my book in the fall, we'll foster. And sometimes it's two dogs. And last year we fostered three dogs. And then my oldest dog, my first dog as an adult, just passed away in July. And so we were down one. So we ended up keeping one of the fosters. Casper. Yeah. They call it a foster. Like, everybody's like, you're not going to want to give these dogs up. It's like, no, you're just as happy when they go to a good home. You know, like the ones that we adopted out or, you know, got, you know, taken last year, it's like, I'm glad that they were taken because we still get pictures from them. One went to Pennsylvania, the other went to New Jersey. And so we got a picture of one of them today. So it's the greatest thing. And it doesn't make you go like, oh, I wish they were here pooping on my floor. It's like, I got plenty of dogs doing that, but I appreciate it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's always my fear is, and we can't do it. Like, my wife established in May that we can't just go like volunteer at the shelter or walking dogs but that's my fear is like, I take these little fur monsters home and there's no way they're leaving.
Yeah.
It's
amazing though. Like, not to go too deep into it, but like, you know, my wife will go down to like a shelter in Mississippi that doesn't get any foot traffic, come back with two dogs, give them baths, have them, you know, play around with our dogs and take pictures of them, and boom, people from all over the country take them. And it just shows that a lot of dogs just, you know, just end up dying or euthanized or whatever because nobody sees them and they just need a photograph of them, and they need somebody to go, hey, they're good with other dogs, they're good with, you know, people, and, you know, they're maybe not house trained, but we're working on it. You know, they're more house trained than they would have been, you know, and sometimes they are house trained. So yeah, it's something we both feel pretty strongly about.
No, I think that's, it's awesome. Fantastic. And another thing that you do, it's not dog related. Having not been in the military, you go above and beyond in other things. And one of the coolest things that you've done is train with some SWAT teams, train like Staccato Ranch and things that really, I mean, I think you definitely would, you know, run circles around a lot of us military vets who have maybe been away from the system a little bit, yeah. Maybe a little too long. You probably know more about, you know, tactics and room clearing and, you know, QCB, all kinds of stuff because you've really done it. How much do you bring back home with you? I mean, you use that research in the book and you find really good ways to, you know, demonstrate that training in certain scenarios that you're putting Corps Gentry through. But I mean, come on, you live in Memphis.
Yeah.
You know, what's it like around the Greeny House when something goes bump in the night?
Well, if I have pants on, I have a gun on, you know, it's sort of the reality around here. You know, I have my bedside gun, which of all the guns I have like two Staccatos and I have, you know, everything. It's a Gen 3 Glock 19 with iron sight, well, actually big dot sight, a big dot front sight. And that's like the most like dependable. If somebody said, grab one thing that is going to determine if you live or die, I would go for this gun that I've had since about 2003 or four. And I've got guns that are quote unquote better. I have a Noveski AR, you know, with a cat titanium suppressor. And, you know, if I had time, I would get to that, but you know, that's not like next to me in the bed. It's not really, feasible for that, but it's close, you know, and, I'm in my back house now and I have a CZ Scorpion 9mm nice. Close by and something on my hip. Oh yeah. I just have a 380 on right now, but, you know, the reality is that's where we are. In fact, I do go right at a coffee shop on a little area near the university called the Highland Strip. And I was just reading an article before I logged on that a guy just got shot up a restaurant there yesterday and shot and wounded like five people. Didn't kill anybody, thank God. But yeah. It's literally that is not a big area. So that's within 200 yards of where I go every day. And
yeah, the Citizen app can be a good thing and a bad thing. If you,
yeah.
you get the notices like, wait, this was just at the mall.
It's next door.
Yeah. My wife hates it because she'll send me texts all the time. And it's like, hey, did somebody lose a chicken? Like literally that'll be like something that's sent. But yeah, anytime somebody's anytime there's gunshots, which around here is all the time. Yeah. And you know, you never know I never say what I would do in any situation because who knows? I might run like a, you know, scared kid. But hopefully, I have the training. I have a buddy of mine who's a SWAT guy and actually trains a certain style of SWAT stuff. And he's walked me through like one person house clearing. You know, like if I had to go upstairs and get to my stepdaughter and you know, we're doing it in my house and I think I've got it figured out. And he's like, well, what about those floor to ceiling windows there that overlook the pool and then your back house? What if there's somebody back there? And I'm like, then I'm just dead, man. There's no way. it's like 700 angles to cover, you know? And so it's a shit sandwich, but you do what you can.
Yeah. No love wins. It. No love wins. It. See right there. Yeah. Genuine, genuine experience. It's fantastic. That's so cool.
Yeah.
All right, John, you got anything? What do you got, brother?
You know what? You went through my notes. We're in sync, man. We've been doing this long enough. You went through pretty much all of my
notes.
That's
the spyware I put on your phone. Okay,
cool. Yeah. That was one of my questions, and you mentioned you hit on it. Like, how do you keep that series going? And as you're, you know, you're saying, you're just always tossing stuff back and forth. And it's what gets me with this, the thriller genre is like trying to keep that wave. It's like, is there like when you're, say you're 60,000 into your 140,000 words that you know is coming down the pipe and you're looking at the news feed that's going off to your left, are you just like, oh man, am I going to be way out of date by the time this comes out? Or is a new techno gadget that I want to introduce here just going to end up being like, you know, has been by the time I get to it? Like, do you feel stressed when you're writing like on the edge?
Yeah, I do feel stressed. So like in this book, when I was writing this book, the last act of the story, you know, it's a very personal story between these characters. And I don't ever want people to lose sight of, like, you know, the personal stakes in the story. But there's also this big geopolitical thing that's going on. And the last act of the story is this big cross-border raid, and it involves Ukraine and Russia and some other Western military equipment. And so I was doing a lot of research on drone technology and also the drone tactics, as well as I can understand, you know, open source wise, that Ukraine was using, and the air defenses that Russia was using. And, like, you know, because you could read articles about, like, yeah, they're really weak inside. They're using so much air defense around the oligarchs' houses or whatever that, yeah, you know, this entire state is just, you know, they're just open. So I was trying to stay on the cusp of that. And I'd write a draft, and they'd use certain types of drones and a certain number of drones. You know, like, there'd be days where it's like, Ukraine sent 22 drones over the border last night. I'm like, oh my gosh, okay, there's going to be 30 in this military thing. And then a couple weeks later, it's like 43 drones went over. And then pretty soon it's like 240 something drones. And now they've got drones that are hitting over 1,000 kilometers away. And so if I was adjusting as the edits would go on, I'm like, I'm making this bigger scale and bigger scale. But I will say, out of 26 books, for 25 of them, I was really trying to hit the nail on the head of where the world would be when the book came out. But for this book, I told myself very early on, let's be more hopeful than you really expect the world to be. There's a character in this book called Nathan Yarovoy, who is essentially Alexei Navalny, except he's not dead. He's like, he's in prison. He's being worked to death. He doesn't have long, but he's Alexei Navalny was the last, you know, major, I guess, threat to Putin's rule. Not much of a threat because, you know, Putin had him poisoned, then had him, you know, imprisoned, and then had him killed. And, but I sort of like dialed the clock back a little bit, and he's in prison and he doesn't have long to live. So that's making it a little more hopeful than I see it. And there's Russian resistance fighters in the story that are more organized and more robust than they are, you know, or that I've heard that they are, you know, like people in Moscow who are doing sabotage operations. Most of that, if you read, that stuff's happening all the time, but a lot of times that's Ukrainian intelligence or Ukrainian intelligence hiring people, or just drones. But there are some Russian rebels doing some things. So I made them a little more organized. I also made them less ideologically screwy because I didn't want to use like real groups, because there are real groups, but you know, they hate Putin, but they're also anti-Semites or some other thing. And I'm like, I'm not getting into all that. You know, I made them more, you know, valiant and idealistic, I guess. But I did that on purpose. But as far as the, you know, hitting the nail on the head geopolitically wise, I spent a lot of time wondering if Kharkiv was going to fall, because Kharkiv is a setting for something that happens in the book. And I kept going like, maybe I should move this, you know, 50 kilometers west or something.
Yeah,
and
a little further west.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, I was like, I'm just going to roll the die, or, you know, like, pray, not for my own book, but, you know, for reality reasons, that Kharkiv stays in Ukrainian hands. And it has. So, no big changes to what I suspected would happen, but there are some things in the book that are more hopeful than reality.
Yeah, just watching on the edge. But I will say that the quote, Navalny's quote that you put, that is just such a powerful quote. But
yeah,
and it's the guy, when you look at it, I mean, the quote captures it perfectly. But you watch this guy go through all of it, and he knew right from the start that he wasn't going to get out of it. He wasn't going to survive any of that. But the quote was, if they kill me, then you know that we're more powerful, that they're afraid of us, and that we're more powerful than they can imagine. It was just it is an uplifting and very sad quote.
So, it's, I think he saw his fate, and he saw that his death would, you know, hopefully cause change. I would argue that he should have stayed in the West and should have stayed an opposition figure in the West and not gone back to Russia, because, you know, I think everybody knew what was going to happen. I can't imagine making that decision, but he felt like that was the right thing to do.
Yeah. And every time you see him, or every time you read about him, it's like, he knew it. Like, it's just, it's wild. Yeah. Those kind of figures baffle me.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, it's a big tour. It's a big book. I mean, in terms of how great it is, it's regular length, right? Don't get intimidated, everybody. Midnight Black. Like I said, go out and grab it. You're not going to want to miss anything Mark Greeny's doing now, folks. So, Mark, thanks so much for your time.
You bet.
Anything else you want to add? Did we miss anything? Any parting shot to anybody?
No, I'll just say, now let's talk politics. No. I hope people will check out my website. It's my name, Mark Greeny, G-R-E-A-N-E-Y books.com. And they can see more about me there. And I'm on all the social media channels.
And when we blast this out, we'll tag you on all that stuff. And we'll continue to support what you do. Love it. And keep up the great work. Really appreciate you coming
out. I appreciate it, guys.
Appreciate you joining us. Thanks.
Yeah, enjoyed talking to you guys.
Thanks, Mark.
Good night, everybody.